work out for anybody these days with the subway, so that's part of the problem. Now, I am extremely happy to have Sean McAuliffe here today. This is the last of this year's seminar series. This brings to an end our most successful year of seminars that we've had. And like today, we've had a huge response on Friday afternoons for our event, and it is of course particularly important for us to have star power on the last day of the year. And even though we have to shift the time, we still have a full room on a Friday afternoon, so I'm quite happy about that. And I realize that some of you will have to go earlier, and that will be fine, and I will not spend too much more time wasting your time. I just wanted to say that I am happy we were able to do this because it connects a few things that we've been trying to do at the City Institute for quite some time, and I've been waiting for you to come and be here, and this is a good moment now. Sean McAuliffe is known to many of you. He is, of course, the author of Stroll, Psychogeographic Walking Tours of Toronto, and I must say that over the last year we've had visitors from around the world, and in the City Institute there were visiting scholars, and they ganged together and they took your book, they took it literally out on the road, and they visited certain parts of Toronto under the guidance of your book and with local people that knew places particularly well, and wrote about it. So it actually spawned something beyond the book as a local book, as a book that we as Torontonians have been using for quite some time. Sean has been the senior editor and co-owner of the independent Jane Jacobs Prize-winning magazine Spacing, which all of you know, in 2002 while resident at the Canadian Film Center's Media Lab. He co-founded the location-based mobile, documentary project. Begun in Toronto's Kensington Market, the project has spread throughout the city into more than 20 cities globally. He was also the founding editor of the weekly Toronto web magazine, Young Street, an instructor at OCAD University, and was a columnist with iWeekly. He writes about cities, culture, buildings, art and politics in book magazines, newspapers, and websites. During the 2010 Toronto municipal election, Sean brought back to life Toronto's first mayor and rebellion of 1837 instigator, William Lyon Mackenzie, in the form of a popular anonymous satirical Twitter account known as Rebel Mayor, we all remember that, and is currently a Canadian Journalism Fellow at Massey College at the University of Toronto, and of course the most active Twitterer that anybody can think of. And I had something else to say, but I won't steal any more time. Sean, please take it away. You're going to talk about how to love your city and avoid the culture war.
Yes, thanks. And I apologize for being late. I almost switched my slides on the way here because I took the TTC. And you all probably know about this since you have to do it every day. They shut it down and we were stuck in the tunnel slowly. And then they told everyone to get out at St. Clair. So I got out at St. Clair and found an ATM and found a cab. And then it's slow. So anyway, I apologize. But it was ironic because I was getting mad and I was swearing on Twitter. Which is what you do when you're angry, which is horrible. But you got this thing where you can just wants you to vent. And so I was yelling about Toronto and the TTC, and I was like, oh, I'm coming to give a lecture about how to love your city. Toronto really can put you to the test of how far you'll go to love it. And the reason I wanted to talk about this today is because we've been through 2 years now of the race to tear Toronto apart, it seems. And it started at the beginning of the last municipal election when it seemed like David Miller, this is a 2010 November-ish, when he said he was not going to run again, so that's almost 2 years ago now, so it opened up the landscape for new candidates to come in. And just about every candidate kind of ran a negative campaign about how broken and awful Toronto is. And so it was a race to out awful each other. And no one can compete with awfulness the way Rob Ford can, or at least the evoking of awfulness. So Smitherman is out of his league when you try to say how bad Toronto is, because Rob Ford has the And that was one of the reasons I started this that Twitter account, fun Twitter account, Rebelmare, because it was such a negative thing early on that I thought it needed a little comedy, it needed a little court jester. So having this character, this kind of rebellious, snarky character, who this kind of gruff Scottish guy, come back and make jokes about everybody, no matter what political stripe they're in, and make a lot of sex jokes and other things. It was a lot of fun. And because it was such a negative campaign, everybody out negativing each other, except for Joe Pantalone, who was kind of a Pollyanna candidate, there was all this space to kind of create this character, and it was a lot of fun. But since then, since Ford has been elected, and especially in the last 3 months, 4 months, as Toronto City Council has sort of found its legs and found its balls, for lack of a better word, and stood up to the mayor, and a lot of these new councillors, I think there's about 13 or 15 new councillors, have kind of figured out how council works, because it is kind of an arcane thing. There's been this sort of, it's not a revolution exactly, but an epiphany that, wow, Mayor Ford, he doesn't necessarily run the city, which is a little bit unprecedented. But every wedge that we can see, that you can conceive of, is starting to be has been thrown at Toronto. So people are fanning the fire of the downtown urban divide, downtown suburban divide, transit riders, car drivers, the war on the bikes, the war on the cars. There's a war on everything in the city, at war with itself. So it's like this giant hydra of war. Sometimes it seems if you just kind of sort of skim the surface of the city. I will try to do this without being too Pollyanna, but I think the city is a lot more united than we think it is, perhaps. And this is a sort of random array of thoughts that I've had that have come out of other things I've written or things I've observed of ways that we can avoid the culture war that some people want us to have for their own political gain. And I think if we kind of see ourselves as one city, one kind of proud city that we love it, it'll be easier to avoid these wedges. Are we still allowed to love Toronto? In 2003, David Miller beat Mel. No, he didn't. He replaced Mel Lastman, but he beat some other people. There was this moment around 2002 as Lastman was a lame duck mayor, and Miller was coming in. It was this new regime, fresh ideas, and it was very much the city building. Jane Jacobs endorsed him. Rise of Toronto, or what some people call Torontopia. This kind of re-loving of Toronto. So because we had this kind of dark era. I mean, now, in retrospect, the Lastman era didn't look so bad. I miss the little guy. But there wasn't much in the way of either city building or just sort of embiggening of the civic spirit. Because we had just been through, that was 2003, 5 years before amalgamation, which threw the city into disarray, which it still is in recovering from. So it was kind of lost, finding itself. Art Eggleton, the mayor, the longtime mayor before in the 80s, wasn't the most inspiring guy. We had a couple of good mayors in the 90s. But Toronto kind of slumped from that 1970s David Crombie, Red Tory, Tiny Perfect Mayor era when it was a city that worked, it was clean, and it was the envy of everywhere else. So around 2002, there was this rise of Torontopia. People doing spontaneous art projects in the city, about the city. People writing about the city in terms that were kind of the way people in New York write about New York or the way Londoners write about London. It was kind of new for Toronto at the time, and kind of awesome. That's where we started. That's the kind of ferment that we started Spacing magazine in, and I started the Murmur Project, and there were all these other kind of indie things going on that were happening. And that kind of rode through David Miller's regime for both his terms, and we're not complete supporters of David Miller, because not that much always got done under him. And when we look back on it critically. But there was this feeling that the city was moving forward. And then Rob Ford came in, and it was like everybody wasn't allowed to celebrate Torontopia anymore. Yet almost felt guilty. It was like a downtown elite pleasure. Anybody that evoked Toronto in loving terms or had Toronto-y projects, cute things, they knitted stuff, and put it cozies around fire hydrants, or they did fun chalk things, or they ran a blog pulling out people's stories from either downtown or uptown or wherever. There was this feeling that it was all silly, and it was all fluffy, liberal, non-serious stuff. And now was the time, with Rockford, he was going to clear all that garbage out, and the real Toronto was going to rise, which he portrayed and his people portrayed as the suburbs. So I think a year after he's been elected, a year and a bit, I think Toronto is coming out. It was kind of like a knockout blow. It was like this kind of harsh thing that the people that love Toronto in this way are kind of slowly recovering from and figuring out again that we are in fact able to love Toronto. So what I propose is, because that first Torontopia happened mostly in the old city of Toronto, downtown, you know, from, say, Hyde Park to the beach, up to, I don't know, St. Clair or something, with spots in between elsewhere. The second wave of Torontopia, Torontopia 2.0, should be the whole city. And I think we need to reposition the spiritual heart of Toronto to Yonge and Eglinton, which offends some people, the hipsters and the fixie bike riders downtown, and the people that hang out at the Dark Horse Cafe may not like it. But Yonge and Eglinton, look at it. It would be the envy of any other city in Canada or Midwestern city in America. It's like a real city. It's a downtown. It's a metropolis. If you didn't know anything about Toronto and you were given this picture of Yonge and Eglinton, you would say, wow, what a city. It's impressive on its own. At some of our spacing parties, we have this giant map that's like, it would go the full length of this wall, and we have people put stickers on it. And one of the questions we ask is, put a red sticker on where you think the heart of Toronto is. And of course, there's like a mound of stickers over Queen Spadina, Yonge and Bloor, all the way down Horrible Queen West. That's what people think the heart is. And then there's a little smattering of it. But if we can reposition that, the idea of what the middle of Toronto is, and sort of redefine what Toronto is, to Yonge and Eglinton, suddenly it's not down in this tiny little part anymore. It's right here in the middle of Toronto. I think this is good for a couple of reasons, because it's on Yonge Street, and Yonge Street goes the entire length of Toronto. It crosses through all kinds of territory. From low-rise to bankers in the towers and wealthy strip halls just down here, all these mom-and-pop stores in them. And then there's Eglinton, Crosstown Eglinton. There's wonderful Queen Street down here, but it really only goes from here to here. And it's a tiny part of Toronto. And if I was giving this talk in downtown, I would probably go on a little bit more about this, but because we're up here, and you guys know all about this, you understand the size of Toronto. And I think a lot of Torontonians who kind of live in that south of Bloor life or south of Eglinton life don't get how freaking big this place is. Like, it's Los Angeles big. If you were to fold Scarborough over, which starts right here, Scarborough would cover pretty much all of Toronto. It's a big city. So one way, I think, is to start thinking of the middle of Toronto as Yonge and Eglinton. And then the love will spread. As a thing to do, I would say, when people say, "How much should I do in Toronto to get to know the city?" I always tell people, walk Yonge Street from the beginning to the end. Well, it goes all the way up, but start at Steeles. Start at Steeles and walk down, because it's mostly downhill. Everything slopes towards the lake in Toronto, with a couple uphills in between. But you do go through every kind of microcosm of Toronto, every kind of typology that we have in buildings. And socioeconomic strata. So that's the best way to figure out, I think, kind of get a grip of how big Toronto is, up and down anyway, and kind of what it looks like and the range that it has. You can do it in probably 5 hours. I've done it in 5 hours. But it might take more if you stop in bars. Eglinton doesn't go all the way to the edge of Scarborough. You can keep going down Kingston Road. And it's equally a good street to walk or ride the bus, or one day ride the subway LRT thing that they will build eventually. But it is the middle. So a couple thoughts. I think, again, I'm going to jump around a bit. A couple thoughts about Mayor Ford and the people who voted for Mayor Ford. And I think I like these people because they remind me of me or how I grew up in Windsor, in a working class town, in a working class family. This was August, I think, of 2010. It was the second of what are now known as Ford Fests at his mom's compound in Etobicoke off Royal York Boulevard. This big old sprawling three-story ranch kind of house with a huge backyard and all this kind of weirdo statuary in the back in a pool. And my friend, a writer at the Globe and Mail, Ivor Tossel, and I, we toyed with the idea all week, let's go to the Ford thing. And Ford was not yet a serious candidate, or considered a serious candidate by most of the media. He kind of seemed like the joker that he was on council for 10 years. And we decided we were going to go, and then Friday night came around, and we're not going to waste a Friday night going to a political thing in Etobicoke. But then we did, we talked each other into it. And we get up, going up Royal York, and there's a glut of cars, like a traffic jam, trying to park on lawns. The entire strip mall across the way was filled with cars. They couldn't park in there. There were cops directing traffic. There were all these kids in Ford Nation t-shirts telling people where to go. And Ivor and I found a place behind the strip mall to dump the car. And we were walking, and we were like, holy shit, this is... Like, it was one of those moments where we realized this guy is going to win, and this is way bigger than anybody knows, because very few people who write about Toronto hang out with, quote-unquote, the Ford Nation. And what I realized at this party, because they were a sort of a faceless group, an angry group that doesn't like Toronto, and then at this party, I realized that it was the people I grew up with, that I went bowling with, the people I'm related to in Windsor. But Windsor has a tradition of labor, CAW, organizing, as well as NDP. Windsor's been NDP in provincial or federal off and on probably 70% of the time in the last 20 or 30 or 40 years. So in Windsor, there's this sort of history of leftiness that will suck up this kind of population that I grew up in. Whereas Toronto doesn't have that as strong. Toronto's a bigger place. And it ties to labor, ties to leftiness, unless you live within a kilometer of the Carrot Common in Jack Layton's old riding, it's a little loose. So I realized that Ford was able to tap into this population of people that can kind of float around and go either way. So what I bring this up for is that Ford voters are not bad, they're not the enemy. They don't hate Toronto. They're closer to us, or at least they're closer to me, and I think I'm closer to... I'm Toronto-y and love Toronto. They're closer to me than different. But Ford just kind of spoke in this language that they got, and there was this kind of climate at the time, a need for change, and it all worked out. Ford Nation hopefully will not be Ford Nation when the next election comes around. But they are not Toronto haters, and they're not Neanderthals. They're just normal people working, and they're gonna vote for who appeals to them directly the most. And Ford did. Whether or not the kind of city building forces have the ability to come around and speak that language, we'll see. Because it is harder, because Ford is a bit looser with the truth. I would be a bit partisan now about things and people who. City builds, whatever political strain they're from, tend to tell the truth more, maybe. But it's not Ford Nation's fault. What happens at City Hall on a monthly basis, the arguing and the speeches you hear, is not always Toronto. It's not reflective of Toronto. So we think of the kind of dysfunction of the place. Last week, I wasn't down there, but I was following closely on Twitter. It was like a fist fight almost broke out. Nunziata, the speaker, had to call a timeout for 5 minutes because it was almost going to become like, you know, like Taiwanese parliament where they're throwing fists at each other. Another unprecedented thing in Toronto, but good to see it get that angry. So there's a lot of bluster and a lot of combativeness and down on Toronto-ness that comes out of City Hall that you see in the news clips. Or you see this guy giving his introductory speech when Ford was sworn in about the Pinko bike riders and all that. But if you actually go down to City Hall, which I would encourage you all to do, because it's a magnificent piece of theater to go down there, and you see all the stuff that the cameras don't catch, and or the tweets don't catch, or whatever. Because you see guys like the Ford brothers, and you see their body language and the way they move around the place, and they loom over people. So you see like the element of bullying, or the bullying of passiveness, where they will sit back and just not even care while someone next to them is speaking. So there's that aspect of it, but then you get to watch all the other counselors work, and this is what's happened in the last 4 months. Council has been working like a council should, like a true democracy should, across political lines and forging deals, and you see it happening in the corners of the rotunda there. People will kind of gravitate back to out of camera range near the velvet ropes and chat, and then they'll go chat to another counselor, and you can tell that that's where the deals are being made. And then when something is proposed, it passes, like has happened in the last few months. But that's not the stuff you see necessarily. So there's this kind of, the media view of city council is that it's this raucous, stupid place, which it often is. But there's this whole element of cooperation that happens and that has magnificently been happening in the last 4 months. So that's another way of keeping your love strong for Toronto. Looking deeper. The suburbs. You hear this a lot downtown, and especially after Ford won, it's the suburbs' fault, and they're to blame. The S&M crowd, the Scarborough and Mississauga crowd, or what in New York City would be the Bridge and Tunnel crowd. All these terrible things that people say about the suburbs. Very linked in with that Ford Nation and that Ford Rob Ford party we went to, the suburbs aren't at fault. We can critique the built form of the suburbs, we can critique the planning patterns, the sprawl, the whatever, but we can't make it personal, because people live in the suburbs for a whole bunch of reasons, not because they're assholes, not because they're anti-urban, they just end up there. I grew up in the suburbs, and the suburbs of Windsor, sort of the sprawly, almost the Pickering of Windsor. And I think back to why my parents moved there. They moved there because it was a house they could afford. It was nice, had a lawn. And they weren't thinking about urbanism because that just wasn't part of their life. And they ended up there, and I think they're still good people. And my mom still lives there. And so depersonalizing the suburbs a bit in that kind of blame thing is quite important. And I bring this up because, and I'm not accusing anyone of doing it, but you hear it all the time, whether you're sitting around. It's just such an easy thing to toss out about the suburbs, all the stupid suburbs, the poorly dressed suburbs, the whatever. And they're much more complex than I think a lot of people give it credit for. So if you ever hear somebody saying that, like, challenge them and say, what do you mean by it? If you can get over the Toronto passive-aggressive way we deal with people, you can, which is hard. Never talk about the amalgamation. Another thing that's come up a lot in Toronto in the last year, we got to dump the suburbs. I think the amalgamation is the saddest kind of, it's like giving up on the city. We've been amalgamated since 1997, so that's 15 years, 16 years, whatever. That's a long time that we've been a city. At this point, there's been enough kind of cross-borough integration, dating, job going to and whatnot, that to start talking about the amalgamation is to kind of just give up. And I think we're so far into the thing that to de-amalgamate would be not only a logistical, bureaucratic, political nightmare. I just think it would be a spiritual letdown that we're giving up on a part of the city that I would argue is sometimes the most interesting. The suburbs hold the Toronto that we, I think, idealize. Not necessarily the built form, but we always talk about multicultural Toronto and how great that is. When I walk down Queen Street West, you know, the galleries and the Dark Horse cafes, people tend to look like me, more than not. When they come to the suburbs, they don't. So all those kind of fuzzy, happy Canadian Toronto things that we like about Toronto actually happen in the suburbs. So to talk about dumping those boroughs, we'd be giving up, I think, on the idea of Toronto. And if we do have that ideal of Toronto, we got to keep them with us and figure out how to make this whole thing work. A thing to accept is that we're a teenage city, which is, I think, why things like the war on the car, the war on the bikes, all that sort of thing that we've been seeing can happen. This picture was taken in 1934 from the Canada Life Building at Queen and University, looking at downtown. So this is Depression-era Toronto. The CIBC building is the tallest. It's Royal York. It stayed this way until about 1950-ish, because nothing happened during the Depression, nothing happened during the war, and it was only around 1950 that stuff happened. Smaller buildings, and then 64, 68, 66. The TD Tower was the first really tall modernist one, and City Hall next door in 64, 65. So it wasn't that long ago. We were a kind of dusty Midwestern town. The kind of town where you can drive your car without too much traffic problems and park in front of wherever you want to go. So that kind of expansive, slightly suburban form is still, I think, deeply in the DNA of Toronto, which is why talking about transit is so difficult here, because we're still attached to our cars, because the city wasn't urban, and it hasn't been the world city that it is now for very long. You go to Chicago, or you go to New York, or Montreal is a better example. Montreal and Chicago, and you walk around the streets there, and those, it feels different, because those are cities that knew that they were going to be capital A alpha cities from the beginning. So they built themselves appropriately with infrastructure that was big. They built they built their homes and their buildings right to the sidewalk. So even at the edges of the island of Montreal, far from Saint Laurent, I'm always struck that the homes are often right to the sidewalk in this very kind of hard urban thing. But downtown Toronto, you go up here to Sullivan, around McCall Street and those places, and Baldwin Village, all the houses tend to have little front yards. So it's like this kind of really subtle suburbanness, even downtown. So I think we need to kind of accept that this stuff is not going to happen overnight, turning to more big city, alpha city modes of transit. It's going to take a lot longer for people to come around, especially people that don't necessarily live where they can walk to places. So we have like a kind of soft sell, and we can't, which is why people get their backs up when transit, and maybe Transit City was sold a bit like this, that this will be better for you. We know it's better for you. When it wasn't taking into account how people actually live, or that history of this is how we live, what is wrong with the way I live? This is just us, it's reality. So I think it takes a much gentler hand to kind of change that mass civic feeling about ourselves. A lot of us live like this. I live on the sixth floor of somewhere downtown. A lot of people live higher. Toronto, I'm fuzzy on this fact, but Toronto has the most high rises over 10 stories, behind only Manhattan and Hong Kong, I think, but that gives or take. But we have a lot. The idea of Toronto, when people picture it, most of us picture, still when I picture it, is of, I don't know, Little Italy or the Annex, or Cabbage Town. You know, like Victorian homes, single family, maybe there are duplexes, tiny little yard. And that's the idea of Toronto. The mythology of Toronto that's been sold to us is this kind of, these nice streetcar suburb, pre-war streets. But the reality of Toronto is this. So many Torontonians, especially new Torontonians, who don't have that history of being sold the Annex or that fuzzy urbanism, people who are new to the city, who arrive in Malvern or who arrive at Brimley and Lawrence and live in a tower next to five other towers, that is Toronto with them. There was an amazing Tim Hortons commercial two Christmases ago, maybe it came out. And Tim Hortons sells the idea of Canada better than anyone. They almost should be the in charge of state propaganda for Canada. They sell the idea of, you know, you're sitting at the hockey game and you're drinking your thing, or whatever it is. But there was one where this lonely guy was sitting in his high-rise tower because they did an establishing shot showing something like this, a little, you know, nice incandescent glow coming from one. And they showed him getting up and getting into his car and driving to Pearson. I assume it was Pearson. They didn't explicitly say it was Toronto, but it was Canada. Driving to Pearson and picking up his wife and kids, who were very ethnically wrapped in the Tim Hortons way, and brought back to here. And it was the first time, it was a little heavy-handed and a little bit saccharine, his Tim Hortons, but it was the first time I saw the reality of Toronto life and Canadian life expressed in such a mainstream, major corporation way. So that's like, if Tim Hortons is getting it, the rest of us can get it too. So I think Torontonians resist thinking of ourselves as a vertical city, but if you fly in from either on Porter down the front, or if you're lucky enough to fly into Pearson and it does that wonderful circle when it's like, you know, you've got to kill time up there, you circle the whole city and you see down Yonge Street this perfectly almost Manhattan-ish spine of buildings going from the nodes from the North York City Center, and then a bit in Lawrence, and then Eglinton, as we saw. And by St. Clair, it's pretty thick all the way down to the lake. And it always, to see it that way, because we're used to seeing it here, it always shocks me out of my idea of Toronto. I'm like, holy cow, what city is this? It is a high, sky-reaching city. So I think if we accept that we live, many of us live in towers, and kind of bring that into our mythology, it might help us not exclude a lot of Torontonian life that we might if we have this other now antiquated, somewhat minority vision of what the city is. If you live downtown, you will probably daily hear somebody make a negative comment about condos. Oh, another condo is going up, more condos. If it looks like something is, if there's a bulldozer, someone without even knowing what's going in there, they'll say, oh, another condo. Which always is curious to me. I don't know why people don't like condos. And I try and flip that and say, do you not like people? Is that what it is? So it seems extremely misanthropic. We're totally allowed to dig on bad condos. Condos with shitty design, like City Place perhaps, down by the Air Canada Sky Dome. Has a kind of crummy streetscape. It feels like a mall. It kind of feels like the back of a mall when you're down there. And there's been a lot of recent articles about whether City Place is going to make it or not, or whether the demographics will stay solid. Is it an actual community, or is it just people being a tenant for a year and then moving on somewhere? So those criticisms are fine, as well as the environmental criticisms that are coming out now, that these buildings, a lot of the glass towers, are heating the sky. You know, these pipes of heat, because the glass, in just the way that the concrete floors are built, it just sends energy out. As well, some of them might fail in 20 years, and then that's going to be a disaster for condo boards. But that, those criticisms aside, condos just mean more people. So if you come across someone who says the condo thing, kind of dig a little deeper and say, what do you mean? Is it the people you don't like? Do you like Toronto being at the population now, and that's a whole other story? That you can get into with them, or is it just bad design? So people or bad design. I'm in the bad design camp. I don't like shitty condos, but there's a lot of really nice ones. And I always think when there's one going up in front of my house in front of my apartment. I've been watching it grow in Jarvis and Bloor, and it slowly goes up. And I think it makes the sky less lonely. When I look at the sky, you know, I live in the city. If I want the sky, I'm going to go to Muskoka. But I live in the city because I like to live around people and the whole metropolisness of it all. And so when there's more people in the sky is less lonely. And there's that wonderful moment when a new condo is being built, and there's so many going up in Toronto, that we just kind of see these shapes around us, that when the first light gets switched on, it's like, that's when we notice it. And it's like, what is it? It's like a new star in the sky or something. And it's this wonderful realization that we get to have all the time in Toronto, at least I have. That first moment, a light goes on, and there's like a human being up in the sky where there wasn't before. And I think that's a magnificent thing. Challenge people who hate condos and ask them why. This, I think, is somewhere around Jane and Finch. This is most of Jane and Finch looks like this, contrary to whatever its media portrayal is. And I think, and this is very similar to how I grew up, and now that I know people who live in the annex and go to their houses for parties and stuff, and they've lived there since the 60s when they were hippies, annex life and suburban life are pretty close, I think. And this is where I probably verge on being a little Pollyanna, but I think if you were to talk to people who live in structures like this, that what they want from their city is very similar to what people in the annex or Little Italy or Cabbage Town or Riverdale or wherever want. They want, you know, nice front yard, like a kind of streetscape that's safe so their kids can walk along it. They want a nice park. If you ask a little deeper, maybe they want a good library, they want a good school. The values that we have, the point is, the values we have are much closer together than farther apart. And I think if we were to test this, and I haven't, in some sort of poll, if we could, some one of you would get a shirt grant and do it. I think we would find that the values, the core values, are you know, we're Canadian, and whether you live in the suburbs of Toronto or downtown Toronto. So I think we need to kind of focus, and this is one way of maybe appealing around that Ford juggernaut, is to start appealing to the shared values we have in sort of language that we can all kind of understand. So let's talk about these pictures alongside of nice pictures of college and Clinton whenever we can, and kind of match the two, because they're closer together than farther apart, even though they might be, as I found out tonight, an hour and a half commute to get between the two. Car drivers aren't bad. I think I went on a couple of those critical mass rides, you know, where everyone meets on a Friday night, end of the month, and rides around Toronto. And I was kind of shocked, and it's why I never went again, that there were so many aggro people riding their bikes, swearing at car drivers who were just kind of driving along. And it's very similar to why people live in the suburbs. People drive cars because they have to, because transit doesn't get them there. We are still a city that is not perfect. So I think even though I think the war on the car has been cranked up by people who like it running on maximum, I think people who are cyclists and pedestrians and urbanists probably have helped fan the fire a little bit by condemning car drivers just sort of out of hand without exploring that. The suburbs are liberty, and by this I mean economic liberty. The most magnificent streetscapes in Toronto right now, I think, are the strip malls that we have in Scarborough, in North York, and in Etobicoke, and a few that creep in some of the other boroughs. If you were to remove the parking lot, which is usually two rows of cars, sometimes four, depending on the size, and drag that to the right to the sidewalk, it would be the kind of lovey-dovey annex Bloor Main Street that we love. The difference is that these things are affordable for mom and pop operations and for new Canadians who come here. So I sort of, downtown in around Mars, or where we at Spacing have our office at the Center for Social Innovation on Bathurst, we call these things fancy names like Center for Social Innovation, or incubators, startups, all these words that I want to apply to places like this, to little halal shops, or fish and chip joints for some of the kind of older fashioned wasp tentacles that still wrap their way through Toronto. This is a place where somebody with very little capital can start a business. And so some of the businesses that are happening in these strip malls that you can see from the bus on the way back to Downsview are maybe housing the next super successful Orange Julius, or Halal Julius, or something like that. They're just these really exciting places, which is why I think Queen Street, College Street, Bloor Street, depending on where you are less exciting, because it's usually predictable the kind of businesses that can afford to go in there. And out here in the suburbs, there's so much DIY retail and eating establishments that no one strip mall is the same, whereas blocks of Queen Street, sometimes feel the same. And the stores are a little different. They all sell the same Blundstone boots and whatever. You know, like, it sort of repeats downtown. It's like the in Scooby-Doo cartoons when Scooby-Doo and Shaggy were running. You know, like in the background would repeat itself because they couldn't afford enough animation to make, you know, a unique strip behind them. So they just kept cutting and pasting. Whatever they did. Kind of downtown feels like that. The suburbs don't feel like that. So I think a recognition of how exciting the suburbs are economically. The ethnic thing I talked about is a little more probably easier because we go out there and we can visibly see that the people are different, and this is where diversity and multiculturalism actually lives. But the economic side is something that we should talk about or celebrate more. One thing I think we should do is do more art in the suburbs. This was, which you probably know, the Lenore, what was it called? Lenore Drive project? Drive, yeah. Which happened, I think, 3 years ago, which took over 5 or 6 bungalows just off Shepherd, by Young and Shepherd. That was a York University project. And it was the first really big, maybe so far the really only big one, art project in the suburbs that got a ton of recognition. And it actually explicitly talked about suburban life. A lot of the, I think there were a couple dozen artists that were invited in to do different things to the homes, and many of them addressed what suburban life was like, sometimes in a celebratory or sometimes in a critical way. But I think we need to do more of this sort of thing. Maybe things like Nuit Blanche need a, North York City Center zone, or a Etobicoke. At the bottom of Etobicoke, Islington hits Lakeshore, what was called New Toronto. Maybe we need to have a zone out there. Other things get involved, like economics, and do the sponsors want to dump a lot of money in the suburbs, but that's not my problem. I just think we should start thinking of the suburbs as cultural territory, rather than just places people live and come into downtown. This isn't to say downtown should stop being downtown. Downtown will always be downtown. That Petula Clark song, Downtown, when she sings about downtown, like, she shouldn't change the words to uptown. Downtown is important. We all need this kind of center where we all come in. But just starting to think of it as cultural territory, I think would do a lot. The Scarborough Arts Council, or the Arts Council of Scarborough, one or the other, they're on Kingston Road by the Bluffs, is doing a lot of this. They've hosted some things underneath bridges, like some of the overpasses over some of the GO train stuff. And worked in some of the strip malls. Another thing that I think is going to happen is that as we run out of space downtown for artists to live, just like the cheap economics to open a store, artists and the creative class, whatever that is going to start trickling out into the suburbs. So that'll be something interesting to watch. The places I predict it's going to happen are places like Weston, which still retain a kind of, it does feel kind of small townish, and it has that small town along Weston Road. And it's also linked by the GO train, most importantly, so people can get into the cultural institutions. There's a GO train stop there, as well as New Toronto, so at the bottom of Etobicoke, along the lake, around Islington. I think these will probably be artist neighborhoods. What I wait for is the day one of those neat strip mall bars hosts some indie rock show, and the kids pedal their bikes out, or they ride their bikes to the subway and get off at Warden Station and ride their bikes. And I don't know how they're going to do it logistically, but at some point there will be an indie rock show in a strip mall bar, and that will be an interesting moment. How long? I don't know. I predict. I wrote something in 2005 that it was only a matter of years, and now that's 7 years ago, and it hasn't happened yet that much. So something to think about. And just a few last slides in rapid succession. I think we need to accept to love the whole city of Toronto, not just the pretty parts. And even our pretty, pretty parts aren't as pretty as some people like them to be. And there's this kind of complex that Torontonians have that we aren't a pretty city. People go to Paris or they go to Prague and they come back and they're depressed because we don't look like Paris or we don't look like Prague. And we don't have that kind of continuous, quote unquote, classical beauty that these other cities have. But I was in Paris in December. And it's boring. It's pretty, but it's boring, I think. And I'm being a little bit biased, I'm sure. But it didn't have... And artists that I know that live in Paris and artists that live in other pretty cities like Edinburgh, which is like kind of this Ivanhoe perfect Royal Mile place. They say it's very hard to do new contemporary stuff because the city is defined, almost in amber. Because you know, like the form of Paris, the form of Edinburgh was established 200 years ago or 150 years ago when Haussmann did his thing in Paris. And a city like Toronto, we're much more tabula rasa, and we can create more things. It's a little bit like what Berlin is like now, or a few of these other cities that Berlin had the war, and they're reinventing themselves. We didn't have the war, we're just young. So I don't think there's any time in Toronto I'd rather live than right now, because it's getting this kind of confluence of creative folk, and that sometimes that's business, sometimes that's art, that's whatever. I don't want to sound like Richard Florida, but I think it's that messy urbanism, that unprettiness, that kind of everydayness that lets us do that. It's like this kind of neutral platform where we can do whatever we want, and that's an incredible amount of liberty that people in cities with that heavy weight of design and history don't have. They don't have that liberty to move around. So I think in Toronto, one of the ways we express this is we slam old and new things together really well that other cities have a real hard time doing. So the most audacious example is the ROM, where the classical building had the crystal thing attached to it, which is, whether or not it works inside is a different story, but I think other cities would not have been able to pull this off. And if you walk through the annex, or you walk through some of the older parts of Toronto, there's all these neat little additions that people have put on their house in the 70s or the 80s, sometimes they're modish things, or there's modish infill, walking down a Victorian streetscape, and I think in Toronto it works. Because our form, our built form, hasn't been so overly defined that that we're allowed to kind of do this. And it's sort of, in my head, a metaphor for kind of the slamming together of and mushing together of all the people that come through this place. We can do it with our buildings, and we can do it with our people. But we need to accept that we are a city of messy urbanism. And if you go to Berlin, Berlin has the same sort of excitement, I think, that Toronto has. But it's also a messy urban landscape, unfortunately, because of the war. Us, because we never planned on being a big city. So we just put up, as the architect Bridget Shim says, we built with the sticks. We are the sticks. Toronto was a provincial backwater. Montreal was the important place. So these don't show up very well. But here's Yorkville Lanes, another up Avenue Road. We have really good exceptional mid-century modernism in Toronto, and that's a look, that's a very Toronto look that we don't accept, or it's not really, not that we don't accept it, it's not fused to our mythology. So this, along with the living vertically, this is Hazelton Lanes, but again, it's kind of this classic Toronto thing where you can have a Victorian next to, here a 1970s building, or a Victorian streetscape with glass towers rising behind it. And again, there's not many cities that can get away with it. I personally love this thing, this look. It's almost, it's like this kind of cyberpunk Blade Runner landscape, I think, where we're a little postmodern, where you have old and new living together. Whereas you go to Paris, they're still complaining about Pompidou Center, and they're still complaining about the stupid pyramids in the Louvre. Because they were so shocking that you would do that in Paris, do something contemporary. Whereas Toronto, we can get away with it a lot easier. Just a bunch of pictures I took on a recent walk before I finished. A fun pic, just stumbling upon Yorkville Park with that rock. But then all these Hare Krishnas, which were like kind of like a vestige of the 1970s hippie Yorkville, and then a nice vintage Mercedes. So yeah, our streets let things happen, I think, that other don't. It's a hard sell to get people to love this. And I do think it can be more pretty. I'm not against pretty, I'm not against you know, good streetscape and good street furniture. But I think this is what we are, and we need to start kind of accepting it and still fight for good design and still make things better. But if we accept the liberty that this sort of built form gives us culturally and economically, I think it goes a long way to loving the city. And finally, my only advice is to go walk the city. And I wrote that silly book about it. But you don't have to buy it. You can just go out and walk. There's a great quote that I use from Rebecca Solnit, who is from San Francisco, writes a lot about cities and other things. Just did this magnificent atlas of San Francisco of all these wild maps. But she wrote a book in 2000 called Wanderlust, A History of Walking. And she says, cities move at the speed of walking. So it is only when you get out on foot. And so take the bus out to the end of Lawrence and start walking around that's West Hill, Kingston Galloway up there, and walk around there. And that's when the Toronto's a subtle city, and it's only on foot that you kind of begin to appreciate this sort of thing. So I think that's it.
We should give ourselves some time for questions. Are you leaving now with your groups, gang, coordination? Coordination is leaving? they have a class to go to.
Yeah, no problem.
And so we'll wait until you move.
Okay.
They love you too much. So we can take questions.
I guess a couple of comments. First, there's a place in West Etobicoke, Dundas and 427, I think, called the Rock Pile. Mm. So it's basically what you said. It's like a concert theater in the middle of a strip mall, literally. And they tend to have like 80s metal bands or 80s metal cover bands. They've actually had some pretty decent acts, but if you're looking for something like that, you might find that interesting. I guess the other thing is I find it this sort of like suburban Toronto versus downtown Toronto, I find that kind of new, because I remember through the 90s and maybe even earlier half of the last decade, I felt that metropolitan Toronto was Toronto. A lot of maps, they showed Toronto as Steeles being the border, not the sort of the upside down T inverted line. And even like I live in suburbs of Richmond Hill. I found it, I kind of longed for the days I used to live in the city of North York, when I was really small. So I mean, it seems like it's almost, now it's, instead of being 416 versus 905, I find it's more downtown versus inner Toronto versus outer Toronto. Or, I don't know, I'm not sure if I have a question, was that just a comment or observation?
I think a lot of it is baggage that people have. So if they were here either pre-amalgamation or remember, Toronto when downtown Toronto was a little more defined, and that sort of thing kind of has a long tail into the idea of Toronto now. But like growing up in Windsor and kind of being obsessed with Toronto up the highway, up the 401, I thought that shape of Toronto from Steeles to the end of Scarborough and Etobicoke was Toronto to me as well, and we would drive to Nova Scotia, where my mom was from, on the 401 and never be allowed to stop in Toronto because it was the city and it was bad and crazy. But I'd be at the window, like, looking at it, like, let's go here, quick. And I was jealous of, cousins that lived in Bolton because they were on the end of the GO bus line and they could get to Toronto. So even Bolton felt like Toronto to me. So I think it depends on people's baggage of the place. Some people, like Matt, who I do spacing with, Matt Blackett, he's from North York and grew up in Willowdale, and he says the same thing. But I think a lot of what happens, if I may play armchair psychologist, is that people hate where they're from after a while. They reject that they're from this, like, people move downtown and they're cool suddenly. They're out of their parents' house and they become their own person, and they kind of mix that kind of coming of age with rejecting the suburbs. And it could be from wherever you're from, but because they're from the suburbs, that form kind of gets mixed in, I think. I think that has a lot to do with it. But most people seem to be from the suburbs, And the Rock Pile, I've heard of it. And you have a Megadeth shirt on. So, it sounds like a very Windsor place to go to. But I think it needs to have the indie band go in there and see if there is that kind of cross. I don't know if they're ready to go that far yet.
They have like cover bands, I'm not sure. I've only been there like once because it's far out. So.
But a place like the Rock Pile, if the Rock Pile was, say, in the Junction, which is now on the edge of what is cool urban Jane Jacobs D. Toronto as it's moved out. First the creative class moved in, and now it's young families and whatever, the usual gentrification thing. If the Rock Pile was in the Junction, it would be one of the cool bars right now that people go to in the Junction. So I would say it's probably just a matter of time for a place like the Rock Pile. It's like ready, you know? It's got the stage, it's got the PA, and it's got the kind of crummy beer, and it's waiting for the hipsters. So.
I would like to challenge you on your notion, on your portrayal of the different examples of cities that you would draw from, Paris, Berlin, Toronto. I would like to challenge you on the grounds of, first of all, let me start by saying that in Paris I could take you to places where you kind of go the same way as what you would do in Toronto in terms of perception, that there's a juxtaposition of different styles, it's not uniform, lots of creativity is going on, that it's not the Floridian kind of creativity, but really intrinsic. So the Paris that you see is a Paris that you see as a tourist that spends a week there or whatever you spend there, I don't know. The Berlin that you saw, again, you saw it as a tourist. And when I came to Toronto, I thought that Toronto is an extremely boring city because everything is homogeneous. The entire built environment is totally homogeneous until I started to see that this is not the case. The Toronto that you presented is exactly the Toronto that I also see today. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that we should not play cities against each other. I think it's the way of seeing, the eyes that have to be trained to see the creativity in every place. So that's also the same thing when we talk about the downtown versus the suburbs, where we quite normally predominantly say the suburbs are boring until we go there and we all of a sudden discover that there's a lot of stuff going on in the suburbs and it's actually quite heterogeneous. And as you also mentioned, the strip malls in the suburbs are the places to be at. So I'm just, a little bit throwing something in here because you kind of were saying, oh, Paris is boring, Berlin is interesting, Toronto is interesting. I think we should actually stop playing these games, cities against cities, particularly because you're from Toronto, you're from Windsor, but you really identify with Toronto now. You know every corner of the city, but you don't know the corners of Berlin, you don't know the corners of Paris or wherever you go, whatever, New York. So I think that it is, when you start with saying the Toronto, with your line of loving Toronto and then for the mayor, Ford as mayor and with this, you're either with us for the subways or, my enemy, my personal enemy. So I think that we should actually stop this game of this is boring, this is interesting, this city is better than that city. That's kind of, because we also then play the game of the suburbs are this and the downtown is that. It's kind of the same game.
Yeah, when I say that, I know that there'll always be someone who likes Paris in the audience. But it's sort of a rhetorical sledgehammer, a bit. Because doing Toronto work for the last 10 years, I've constantly come up with this, people will say, and they'll explicitly say, Toronto doesn't look like Paris. Because that's the ideal. And it's always inside of the periphery, the kind of ring road around Paris. So it's that old Haussmann stuff. I know outside in the more suburban areas is where a lot of the stuff that you're talking about happens, and even corners inside of it. But I say it just sort of as a counter to kind of push back. In my mind, that narrative of Toronto being ugly and this being interesting, or this being good, Paris being good as a built form, as a place, just needs kind of like a big whack back. So I'm doing it unsophisticatedly and intentionally provocative, I think. We'll do that.
I've never heard that comparison that Toronto should look like Paris. This is news to me, and I would actually say that to that person would say, in Toronto we have our Victorian boring style, the single family home with the lawns in front of it. In Paris, we have the Haussmann architecture. In Berlin, we have the Steinmann and Berlin Mietskasern, right? These apartment complexes that were built in the 19th century. So we have all these very homogeneous structures now in these cities. And they're very boring. And that's not where interesting stuff is happening. But in the top of that structure, that's where it's actually used. Sorry.
I probably hear it a lot just in the blog comments, and which is probably no way to gauge a city. But just the kind of feedback from writing about this Toronto the way I write about it and kind of coming up against that wall. So I come across it. But maybe it's good to know that it's not super extensive wall or as thick as I thought it was. But I am intentionally being a dick when I say that. And I accept that.
Hands up over here.
Yes, please. I don't know. Are you playing? Okay, please.
Well, why don't you check yourself because you have to see more than I do.
Okay.
I first want to give my full disclosure that I love Trump. So it was great to hear you talk about all the great things that I agree are really interesting about Trump. I actually also recently moved out of Trump, not even to the suburbs, but to a city outside of that. And there's a lot of debate in that city about how to negotiate some new urbanism that's coming into a smaller city. And I was interested in your conversation about denomination and this idea that, you know, people kind of want to go back to the way it was. And that's a lot of what the debate is in this new city that I'm in. So I wondered if you have any advice for how to go into that kind of a conversation about trying to move forward rather than always going back to the way something was. And my other question is, or comment, is that I noticed that Dundas is curiously absent from your conversation. You mentioned College Tour, Queen, Edmonton, St. Clair, but I wondered if you could also comment on the role of Dundas Street, because it is kind of a different, it doesn't fit into the same box as the other streets.
It wasn't intentional, forgetting Dundas. I think I was just kind of quickly going through a mental map. But it isn't one of the shiny streets that the way, say, parts of Bloor is and Queen Street or College. It's always been a little bit down on its luck until recently that the little Portugal strip, say, past Bathurst. A lot of the mom-and-pop places are switching over to cafes now, Ezra's Pound and whatever is going in there, Saving Grace, brunch places. And there's still these kind of, I think I call them widow stores, where sometimes you see a small ethnic black-clad granny kind of go in, and it's the vestiges of a store that's closed, so it's still got the curtains are drawn over the shop windows. And Dundas seemed to have had a lot of those that are going away. So I think I just hopped over it, but it's pretty much, soon it will be on par with those other streets in terms of how prohibitively expensive it is to go there. Yeah. Dundas is in an. I sometimes think of Dundas as our Broadway, because it breaks the grid, and it's a weirdo street, which is why it's kind of fun. But your other comment about and you hear that a lot about. I mean, NIMBYs, from NIMBYism, just a general. We like the city the way it was. But the thing is, the city, and how I would say it back is, the city was never the way it was. If there's any constant in a city, it's that it's always changing. The city is never the same, unless some economic catastrophe happens. Like the Depression, the city stayed the same for 15 years, more or less, because Depression and the war, nothing happened. But that's rare. Cities are always changing and churning, and the battle to save the good stuff has always been there, and fitting new stuff in is the art of planning in a contemporary city. So, it's hard to convince people of that, because what moment are you talking about? Are you talking about when I came here in 2000, you know, if I'm using my own example, or is it when I visited here in 1982, and the Eaton Center was brand new, and that was like still a shock on Yonge Street. So I think trying to convince people that cities are changing, but when you live in a place, and especially if you live in the same house for a bunch of decades, and you look out, and your neighbors change slowly, and the tree grows very slowly, you don't notice change. If you live maybe downtown Toronto in, say, Ward 20 out in Vaughan's Ward, which has the most intense development in all of North America maybe, change is probably a lot more, you could probably talk about change with a person a lot easier in that kind of place because they've seen it happen. Whereas most of the city changes on such a slow pace that we don't notice it, so we think it's always been like that. I wish I had like a time machine, and I would just like to stand in one spot, which you can kind of do with Google Earth sometimes because they have some historic stuff, or you can do it, make your own little thing with archival photos, but just kind of click backwards. And I think it would be shocking to see how much change there is that we don't notice. So when I see a picture that I took on the first digital camera I had in 2003 that is on an old hard drive, it's like, wow, the skyline is dramatically different, and it's only been 10 years. Last point is there was a Coach House Books exhibit, which is my publisher, which has been working in Toronto since 65 at the new AGO when it opened. And on the floor, maybe a quarter of this room, was an aerial view of Yorkville, because they really sucked in a lot of the Yorkville art scene in 65. And so I was walking down Cumberland and Bloor and Yonge, and what was most shocking was that there was so many parking lots in between everything. So, and that was at the peak, I think the photo was taken around 68, 67, the peak of, you know, Joni Mitchell Yorkville, which in my mind was like this thick, seething, urban place. But when you look at it on the thing, like, there was so much space in between some of the coffee houses. There was nothing behind homes sometimes because they'd been torn down. There were parking lots. That's because it was the height of the parking lot era. So I think we get easily confused about things, about how the city was. And once a building is gone, we forget. Once the built thing is gone, we easily forget these things. So how to convince people that, I don't know. Just maybe talk to them and show them old pictures. I don't know about change. Change is inevitable. It is just the way it is in cities. It's why they're fantastic and why they're sometimes scary and volatile. There's one and two.
You know, maybe like specifics to politics and transit and stuff. Would you say your work is like strives to be apolitical, like on that versus right thing? Is that conscious in your writing at all? But
yeah. I think so. I'd like to start. I mean, I was pretty hard on Ford. It's not because he's a conservative. It's because he's not a city builder. He's not a good mayor. And a city like Toronto needs a city building mayor. And some of our best city building mayors, and you can argue about some policies, but Bloomberg, Boris Johnson, I mean, Daley was a little bit conservative. These were, like, their politics didn't matter. They were into their city, and they seemed to want to build it into a better city. So I do think it's apolitical. I like to talk in terms of, and there are people writing around City Hall who stop using left and right, and I like the terms city building, or in Ford's case, it's too red hot, but like city destroying, but just city building versus nothing. So there's city builders, and there's not, and those people can come from any political stripe, and often do come from the right. But then when you kind of get underneath a bit more and you start talking about specific things like housing policy and that sort of thing, then the politics starts to matter. But just sort of in a general sense, I think it can be apolitical. And I think it's probably better because if you don't talk about the politics of it, you can bring a lot more people into the idea of city building before if you just say it's a left thing. Which Rob Ford has done very well about those lefties and their bikes, those lefties and their whatevers, and their brunches and their fixies and whatever. So, I think it's effective to be as apolitical as possible.
Okay. Two more quick ones, and then we need to close it down.
Downtown, so, and then the last one was actually at Downtown. So, I don't know if you have any comments on this use of abandoned streets.
You think of like those extermination parties that happened before and stuff? Crazy art parties? Yeah.
The afterlife parties?
Yeah. Toronto, I mean, that's what all cities seem to do. They're that kind of indie DIY cultural class that doesn't have the capital to rent a proper space will find an abandoned venue or a really cheap venue and throw something together. But I think it's when people do that in Toronto, I'm always really impressed because Toronto, being an economically vibrant city, doesn't have much abandonment. It's very rare to find something empty in the city. Growing up in Windsor, looking across the city in Detroit, we would go over the bridge or tunnel and you know, go to techno parties and old Packard plants and there was just such a surfeit of empty space to do this stuff in, but not as much population. Here we have the population, the critical mass, and there's very few venues. So those ones, they've gotten really creative in Toronto. Like they've done things, not just that those people, but other folks underneath bridges. Often underneath, there was a big party underneath the Bathurst Bridge once. The old Eastern Avenue. There's a stub of a bridge by the DVP and that new BMW dealership right at the bottom by the freeway on ramps that still kind of hangs out over the Don River, but with no connections, and you can sneak into it from the Don River biking trail. They had a party there one night. But I think they're doing what all good cities do, is inhabiting these spaces, and then then it does have the effect of legitimizing them, and then someone takes over the space and makes it nice. So it's an old story, I think, and Toronto participates in that as well as it can with its limited supply. There's one more.
One more was back there.
Why do you hate brunch?
I rant about brunch on Twitter a lot. I think, and I wrote a little piece in a magazine recently about it. I think, friends who have brunch, it ruins their Sunday and they don't get to hang out because, I got to go to brunch at 2, or I got to go to brunch at 1, and they'll leave a party early because they have to wake up and do brunch. So this is a very downtown fae concern of mine. But I think there's this kind of, urban things need a bit of critical view on them, and this idea of going to brunch, where it sits in the middle of your day, like a big kind of, and it's like taking a dump on your day because you can't eat before it, because you don't want to spoil your brunch, and then you ate late, and so you're not going to eat dinner, but then you're hungry right before bed, and it ruins your sleep. When you're done brunch, it's 4 p.m., and so you've wasted the day. You can't go see a movie. You can't go to the beach. There's no matinees. So I support breakfast, and I support lunch and dinner. And these are time-honored things, and they work with our rhythms, and they work with the wonderful space of the afternoon to be free to go live life. And I think if you're stuck in brunch, and also brunch, you're stuck in those little tables at aunties and uncles, and everyone's hungover, and your servers are hungover. It's just bad service and a bad experience, and I don't get why people like it. But it is what urbanites do.
Thanks for that last question. I'm glad we got to talk about the important stuff last. But unfortunately, the camera was off for that, because that would have been a YouTube clip just in itself.
I lose all my friends when I do that, when I go in the
room. Exactly. Thank you. I have to say that I totally agree with what you said about Paris. I just tweeted it out. A morgue it is, and it is for all those symbolic reasons that you mentioned it. And after having been here for 20 years and having done what you did today to come up here on the subway and getting stuck all the time and hating it, I have for the last few years actually begun to understand the diversity, and for you to put it in, like you put it into slides and words today in very precise terms, it is exactly that sort of unexpected mix, the messiness of it, which makes it still enjoyable. And we have a future that comes out of that messiness, which I think is quite distinctive for this body, which doesn't mean it doesn't exist in Paris or in Berlin, but it's good to know that we are now officially allowed to love this rather than hate it. So thank you very much, and thanks for you, for your patience and for staying. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you all again the first Friday of October for the next City Seminar, which has yet to be revealed who the speaker is. Thanks, Sean.
So anything I can do for you, Mara, to take you to have a coffee or brunch, perhaps?
No, this is great. That's lovely.
Well, that's